and you're welcome to episode number 2 of The Sports Writer's Life. My name is Shane Breslin, and this 12-part podcast series is brought to you by Magnificent Irrelevance, a new publishing venture which aims to bring readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing each week. You can find out more about Magnificent Irrelevance and sign up for regular updates in the journey towards making it a reality by visiting magnificentirrelevance.com. The Sports Writer's Life is a series of interviews with writers and editors from around the world. They talk through their past, their present, and their possible futures in the business, and they share their insights into the writing process and the world of sports journalism and media in general. If you'd like to hear a little more about the why behind all this, please go back and find episode 0, my short introduction into The Sports Writer's Life and Magnificent Irrelevance. For episode 2, I'm very pleased to bring you this conversation with Karen Krause. Karen Krause has been a sports writer and reporter with the New York Times since 2005, covering a range of sports, most recently specializing in all things golf. Her Twitter bio says she covers sports from outside the box, and that is exactly the type of thing I'm interested in exploring with Magnificent Irrelevance. At the beginning of 2020, Karen took up a new posting as the New York Times international sports correspondent, an assignment that has turned out to be quite a bit different than expected given the events of this year. Karen has also written an acclaimed book, Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence, which was published in 2018. I really loved this conversation with Karen Krause, and I really hope that you do too. So let's get to it. I bring you episode 2 of The Sports Writer's Life with Karen Krause. Karen, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to talk with you.
Now, the format for this show is 3 fairly standard questions, looking back, looking present, and looking forward. So if we start at the start, Karen, tell us how you got into sports writing.
I have the most amazing origin story for which I can take absolutely no credit. It's all credit to the people that were in my life. I was a swimmer, competitive swimmer from the age of 9 through college with Olympic aspirations. And in 1976, I was in 8th grade and was assigned an English project to create your own magazine. So, of course, I decided I was going to do a swimming magazine. So I came home from school. I was so excited to tell my parents about this creative activity that I could not wait to sink my teeth into. And my dad said, well, who are you going to interview for your magazine? Well, I hadn't thought it out that far. And at the time, I was so shy. Timid would have been a mild description for how introverted I was. So the idea that I was going to go out and interview anyone was insane. So I said to my dad, well, I think I'm just going to make an interview up. So maybe I was decades ahead of the fake news curve. But my dad, who was a salesman, said, well, you're not going to make up an interview. You're going to talk to Mike Bruner. So Mike Bruner in 1976 in America was the Michael Phelps of his day. He was a butterflyer, IMer, freestyler, was expected to make the Montreal Olympic team in multiple events, and he swam on my team in a group, many groups ahead of me, mind you. And he was someone who the young people and on the team, we all looked up to him, but we were scared to death of him. He was a very intimidating figure. This was when feathered haircuts were all in vogue for men, and he was bald. He was just from head to toe the most intimidating figure, not to mention his resume. So my dad takes me to practice and he makes me stay after and talk to the head coach. His name is Bill Rose, wonderful man. And he says, Karen, you tell Coach Rose what your school assignment is. And so I said to Coach Rose that I was putting together a swimming magazine and I wanted to interview Mike Bruner, but I was really hoping he would say, well, that's not possible. So then I could go back to plan A, which was to make up an interview. And Coach Rose looked at me and he thought a moment and he said, okay, Karen, you come to practice tomorrow with your questions and I'll make sure that Mike speaks to you. So I go home, I write questions on 3x5 index cards. I found this out years later that what Coach Rose said to Mike was, you need to stay after practice tomorrow because you have an interview. There's someone here who's going to be interviewing you. So Mike not unreasonably thinks, oh, great, finally the San Jose Mercury or the San Francisco Chronicle or Sports Illustrated has come to talk to me. So you can imagine how mortified he must have been the next day when he comes out of the tunnel from the locker room and sees not a professional reporter from the San Jose Mercury, the San Francisco Chronicle, or Sports Illustrated, but a little girl with wet pigtails quaking in her sneakers, trembling as she holds these 3x5 index cards in her hands. But he was so wonderful. He did not blow me off. He was not rude. He acted as if I had every right to be sitting there interviewing him. So I asked him all my questions. Everything went great. I remember my voice cracking throughout the whole thing. I go home, write the magazine, I get an A, I'm so excited. My father says, well, you know what you need to do now? You need to make copies of this magazine. You need to give one to Coach Rose and one to Mike so that they can see what came of the time that they gave you, which my dad didn't know anything about journalism, but what a great lesson. It's one I try to keep to this day. So I did. I went out and made copies. As fate would have it, my dad had arranged for us to watch part of the Olympic trials, to attend them, because they were in Long Beach, just an hour's flight from where we lived. And this was all happening around this time. So I saved my magazine copies to take to the Olympic trials. So my dad and I arrive at the Olympic trials in Long Beach after Mike has swum his first two events. Now remember, he was supposed to make this team in as many as five events. He swam the 200 free and made it as a relay member, but not as an individual. He didn't finish in the top three. So he knew he was guaranteed basically a gold medal for being part of that 800 freestyle relay team. He swam the 400 free, did not make the Olympic team. So he's having a fairly atrocious meet and is not in a great frame of mind. When I come bounding into the natatorium with my copies of Splash magazine in hand. So this was an altogether different time. I was able to get on the pool deck, which would never happen now. And I gave Coach Rose the two copies and I said, look, Coach Rose, I got an A. Every coach that I've covered as a professional journalist, this is where the story would have ended because they would have patted me on the head and humored me. And then the minute my back was turned, they would have circular filed that magazine. But not Coach Rose. Coach Rose read the interview that I did. It was a Q&A is the form that I wrote it. He gets to this one part and he says, Karen, this is fantastic. I can't wait for Mike to read this. I'm going to have him read it right now. And in fact, he then walks away from me. So the part in question that got his attention was, I had asked Mike, as only an insecure 13-year-old could, what do you do when you get to the big meet and you're not feeling that good in the water? Or you're not really swimming that well. How do you turn things around so that you can swim well? And Mike had answered something to the effect that, well, I know that nobody else has worked as hard as I have. So I trust the process. I trust that my hard work will pay off. So no matter how I feel, I don't worry because I know that I've put in the work to be successful. So I found this out years later. Mike is under the bleachers getting ready for his best event, the 200 fly, and is in a very foul mood, very bad frame of mind. Coach Rose takes the magazine, opens it up to this section and says, Mike, read this to me. He makes Mike read his own words. And in doing so is, in effect, delivering a pep talk. So Mike goes out and wins the 200 fly that night. So he makes the Olympic team in his first individual event. Afterward, a reporter from the Long Beach Press Telegram asked him something to the effect of, "You haven't had the best meet, but you really turned it around tonight. What changed?" So he could have given a glib answer, but instead, bless him, Mike says, "Well, there's this little girl on my swim team, and she did an interview with me, and my coach made me read the interview, and in it, I talked about putting in the hard work and knowing it will pay off, and I had been in such a bad frame of mind that just reading those words really shifted my thinking in a positive way." So again, the writer could have not used that quote, but he did. So the next day I arrive at the pool, and remember, I'm so shy, I'm afraid of my shadow. I arrive at the pool and all of the older kids from my swim team who are at this meet are so excited. They said, "Karen, you were in the newspaper. Did you see?" Well, we hadn't gotten the newspaper, but my dad went out and bought every Long Beach Press Telegram for miles around, comes back, we read it on the deck together. And when I read that quote, I was gobsmacked. I could not believe here was someone who I held in such high esteem. He was on such a high pedestal for me. He was untouchable. And something I had written had helped him succeed. I could not believe it. I remember turning to my dad and saying, "Dad, this is the coolest thing. I want to grow up and do this for a living. I want to tell people stories." And it was such a monumental moment for me. I can't even overstate it, because most of the journalists that you see portrayed on TV are very aggressive and very loud. And I would look at that. This was around the time of All the President's Men. And I would just think, I could never do that. I love to write, but I could never be that way. I'm just not wired that way. So I guess I can't do that. And this experience told me you can do it, and you just did do it. So there's a lovely postscript to this. Mike goes on to win the 200 fly at the Montreal Olympics. He was the first gold medalist for America. So he got a call from the president, who I think was Gerald Ford at the time. And he came back from the Olympics. He returned to Stanford, where he had taken a year off. I went to high school, totally lost touch with him. Decades later, decades on, I get a job at the New York Times. It's 2006. I've been at the Times a few months. And I get a reader email out of the blue, and it begins, "You probably don't remember me, but you have to be the Karen Krause from Deanne's Swim Club. This is Mike Bruner, and I just want to tell you that every time I'm asked to talk about my Olympic experience, I tell the story of how what you wrote helped me to make my dreams come true. And I'm so happy to see that you've made your dreams come true too." Oh. So it's my favorite story. I was just the beneficiary of some amazing people whose generosity helped me become who I am.
I love it. And I love the, it was a Coach Rose?
Coach Rose.
I love the openness and the humility of Coach Rose and Mike Bruner to accept in. I think it's a rare thing to accept in from the outside something. Like, I think most people, and I've seen it up close, how people protect and have a kind of a shell. And it takes great vulnerability and humility and openness to be able to accept in. And for that to happen on the deck at the trials sounds staggering. It's a great story.
Well, so there, this story, I should make a book of just this story, but I was telling this, I had never for some reason really told this story to many people. I had told it to my husband maybe, but and maybe a few others. But in 2012, before the U.S. swimming trials, I told it to our Olympic editor, and he said, "You know, you should write this story. It's very inspiring." And so I did. And after it ran, I received another reader email out of the blue from a woman who had been my best friend in eighth grade. She moved shortly thereafter and we had lost touch. She said, "Karen, I read with great interest your Mike Bruner story. I totally remember that assignment. You were so into it, but I think you might have forgotten it was an extra credit assignment." So the idea that my life turned on an extra credit assignment is, if you know me, is like so me. And when I read that email to my husband, he just nodded his head and said, or he shook his head and said, "That explains so much."
Tell me, for people outside the US, an extra credit assignment might not mean a huge amount. So what does that mean?
I was an A student. I was one of the best students in the class, especially in English. I did not need to bump up my grade by doing an extra assignment. So I, for whatever reason, was enamored of doing this magazine. And look at what it did for me. So that's why I always tell people, go the extra mile, because it could change your life. But back to what you said about Coach Rose and Mike, you're so right. And it's just, I tell the story because you don't have to be in journalism to appreciate the lesson that it provides, is that with really very minimal trouble or time, you can change someone's life. You don't need to be a billionaire to do it. You don't need to have all of the power or prestige or status. Coach Rose, with just having the ability to see like, oh, this is a neat thing. Mike should do this. Mike giving me 15 minutes of his time. I mean, it changed both of our lives for the better. And when that story ran in the New York Times about this, of course, was at the U.S. swimming trials, and Michael Phelps's coach, Bob Bowman, with whom I've since become great friends, but really didn't know that well at the time because he kept everyone at a remove. He came over and said, "So Karen, I read your Bruner story. It almost brought a tear to my eye." And I told him, "Thank you. But what I really wanted to tell him was, you know what, Bob, remember that next time someone asks for an interview with Michael, someone who's not from the New York Times or the Baltimore Sun or Sports Illustrated, wants 10 minutes of your time and 10 minutes of Michael's time. Remember this story." Because I'm not casting aspersions on Bob or Michael, but it's the world we live in now where these athletes are so packaged and their time is so valuable. They're busy. Every minute of their day is scheduled. There just isn't room for this kind of magic to happen. They don't make any allowances for it. And more, as the money has gotten so big, Mike Bruner didn't make a dime off swimming the way people in future generations in America would. But they're just surrounded by people who are controlling their access and what they say and every aspect of their lives. So I think it would be much harder to be an eighth grader in the year 2020 and have an experience like this.
Yeah, totally understand that. So fast forward in a few years from there, where was your entry point after your magazine in eighth grade? where was your entry point into professional writing and journalism?
So I worked for a couple years out of college at Swimming World magazine, so stuck to my roots very much, and then began my newspaper odyssey at a very small newspaper in Savannah, Georgia, on the east coast of the United States. I didn't know a single person who lived in the whole state, much less the city. I was the first woman who had ever worked in the sports department. I think I might have been the last. I might have traumatized these people so completely that they have never hired another woman. It was the Deep South. They just simply did not know what to make of a Californian, a woman in her early 20s who was not attached to a man, who wanted to write about sports. I just didn't fit in any of the boxes that they wanted to put me in. So it was a huge learning experience. Having grown up in California, I had read my local newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News, had one of the first female sports writers in it, Kristen Huckshorn. So I grew up reading a woman's byline in the sports section and thinking it was perfectly normal. So when I went to Savannah, it was my first inkling that, oh no, not only is this not normal to some people, but not everyone is going to be as supportive of you as Mike Bruner, Coach Rose, and my father were. So.
And did you quickly jump into other sports? Did you always have an interest in other sports? Where did you move outside of swimming quite quickly?
Yeah. So that's why I went to a newspaper. I just never wanted to get pigeonholed as a swimming writer. And boy, in America, there is no currency for that except for 2 weeks every 4 years. So I really wanted to write about every sport and was really pretty adamant from the beginning. I don't want to be pigeonholed. I have friends who have found a beat and have stayed with it for their whole careers, whether it's the NFL, the NBA, golf. They really like that. I always wanted to be able to converse and write about everything so that nobody would really know what my favorite sport was or what my specialty was. I wanted sports as a buffet table and not as a diet of one thing. I covered golf for 8 years and it was actually the longest I've ever covered a single sport. But the Olympics have always been my first love because of that was my entree into sports, was swimming with the hope one day of competing in an Olympics. And I never, can I be honest, I never came close to that goal. However, I have covered 11 Olympics as a journalist and would have been at my 12th at this moment in time, if not for the pandemic. So yeah, I tried very early on. I never turned down an assignment. I remember being asked to cover a hockey game. I had never been to a hockey game, but I said, oh, sure, I'll do it. And figured, well, I'll ask questions about what I don't know, but whether I'm covering hockey or swimming or football, I'm really covering people. So I'll figure out the X's and O's on the ground, but it's really, no matter what event I'm at, I'm writing about the people. And that's what interests me the most anyway, what makes these people tick. So,
yeah, no, I love that. And that's very central to this whole project. So it's great to hear you say that. And you've brought it right up saying that you would be right now, as we record this in late July 2020, that you would be at the Games in Japan. What is your day-to-day and week-to-week right now as we speak?
Yes. Wow, I could engage you for the next 5 hours on that question, but to put it succinctly, I moved to London on January 16th to become our European sports correspondent. And the whole idea was that I would get away from the daily grind of a beat of writing 2, 3, 4, 6 stories a week off a golf tournament. And I would roam Europe looking for long narrative-driven pieces that I could really sink my teeth into. And I covered exactly one event in Sweden, a Women's World Cup, and I wouldn't even say I covered it. I was at it the night before it was due to start when the World Health Organization identified the coronavirus as a pandemic. And the skiing got canceled and I came home from Sweden, returned to London and have spent the last few months just trying to figure out how I can be useful when I really don't have any contacts here. I don't even know my neighbors, my neighborhood, much less the sporting scene, and try to do good work for the newspaper. It's been the biggest challenge of my career by far.
And how has that been going?
Well, there were a few things that I felt that I was proud of. I did a story. I've done a lot of stories over the years on athletes and their mental health. And one aspect or piece of that is eating disorders and eating issues. And the one thing I know from having done those stories is that it's all about control. And the less control you feel, the more you try to control the amount of food you put into your body. So I thought, wow, here in a pandemic, none of us have any control. It's such an anxiety-inducing time. What must it be like for some of these people? So I reached out by phone to some people to see if they would talk. And so I felt like that story, again, I'm always hoping with my sports stories to draw in readers who don't think they like sports or don't think they care about sports and help them to see that there are so many commonalities that athletes share with the public at large that that's your way into relating to them. And so I felt like that piece served a purpose. I did some Olympic-oriented pieces. It's really interesting, the sports scene, the playing field is so unlevel right now because countries that didn't have that much of an outbreak, some of them never stopped training. And you're seeing as the competitions resume that some people have picked up right where they left off. And while there are some swimmers in America who still aren't training in any way, shape, or form like they used to. So I think that's really rich material to mine. I think the Olympics, if they are even held next year, that's not a given. You're going to see people rise and succeed who would not have been on our radar right now. And people who were perfectly positioned for success may not really be able to recover from this, these blind curves they've been thrown. So,
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you see as, like, obviously there are two big uncertainties or states of flux right now in the industry in terms of the wider and broader pandemic and the impact of that. And it's going to be far reaching. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, but it's going to have a lot of big impacts. And also at a wider level, media and sports writing and sports journalism was in a state of flux already before that. So where do you see this things going? Do you see any trends or what are your expectations for the next 1, 3, 5 years?
So I have a 3-part answer and I would really be curious if this resonates with you. The first part, my year was going to be insane from the French Open through, I was going to cover the French Open, then a little bit of football, then the Wimbledon. I was going to cover the U.S. swimming trials, then the British Open golf, and then head to the Olympics. So basically from the end of May through mid-August, I was going to be on the go. Every week had something I was going to be covering. The pandemic and the 3 months of sheltering in place has fundamentally changed how I see how I want to live my life. I don't ever want to be on that hamster wheel again. And I say that recognizing the privilege that I have to even be able to say I had those opportunities. But that schedule, which was sort of normalized for me because I have had the last few years have been similar to that, that's unsustainable and it's crazy. And so if there was one good thing to come out of the lockdown for me, it was to be forced to slow down and really look at the bigger picture of, is that really not only A, necessary, but is that really healthy and sane? And I really was looking at it in a way I had never before looked at it. I just was that hamster on the wheel, kept going. Oh, you want me to cover that? Great. Again, I never turned down assignment. So I think moving forward, I don't think I'm the only one who's probably reassessing how I want to cover sports. But that's the luxury. The reality is, how many sports writers do you need when there aren't that many sports being played? I worry every day about my position and whether I'll still have a job 6 months from now or a year from now. I think any journalist, any sports writer who is not worried about that is delusional, because I think we're all expendable. So that's a huge worry. I've already seen furloughed people, more layoffs, and it's just hard to imagine the industry bouncing back, because some of these leagues simply aren't going to make it. They're not going to survive the pandemic. They're going to be like businesses everywhere. And so that worries me greatly. Absolutely. It's always that in the back of my mind that every assignment I do right now, I try to approach it with extra gratitude, because I cannot take these assignments for granted anymore. Not that I ever did, but again, you do get caught up in this is your normal and it is what it is. So there's that access. I think even when all the sports come back, they've all used the pandemic as an excuse in some cases to cut off access. And my experience has been that once you lose access, it does not rebound. Once gone, forever gone. So that's certainly going to change the way that I cover sports. When I was on the golf beat, so many of the stories I got was because I would be out walking the 18 holes with a player, and I would be watching who was watching them from the outside the ropes. And I would talk to parents, I would talk to siblings, I would talk to significant others or wives. And that would help me find the story and flesh out the story. Well, now we're holding sports with no crowds, so that opportunity is lost. In golf, they are having pool reporters, so you aren't necessarily going to be able to even ask the questions you have. And only you know where you're going exactly with the questions. So there's no chance to ask questions or follow questions. So many of the stories I did, I would not ask the questions in front of a lot of journalists, because it was almost like a game of poker, and I didn't want to show my cards. So would I still be able to do that in this new world? I just am not sure. When I look at how I used to operate on a daily basis, so much of it is not even possible now. And going back to my shyness, I hated talking on the phone as a child, and becoming an adult hasn't made that any easier for me. It's really helpful for me to make eye contact, to be able to read body language. So to have spent the last 3 months basically reporting stories off the telephone has been a tough adjustment for me. I don't feel like I operate as well in that space. So these are all things that I'm constantly thinking about. I'm an old dog. I hope I can learn these new tricks, because I still am as passionate about this job as I was as an eighth grader putting together Splash magazine. But I just wonder more and more, is there going to be a place for a lot of us post-pandemic? Absolutely, it's a concern.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And I think that, like, there's the one constant is going to be, or the one certainty is going to be uncertainty, is what it seems to me. And my hope, if I have some optimism, is that there things will change, but there will always be a need for stories or a desire for stories. And where those stories go and how those stories get paid for or rewarded or recompensed is all kind of remains to be seen. But I think the desire for stories is a 100,000-year-old human desire, and hopefully it will last. I think it will. But where those go will be interesting to see.
Well, and the other thing that's getting lost, as a lot of older journalists are losing their jobs, is that there's a lot of institutional knowledge, and I think it's more important now than ever. I'll just give you an example. I was on a Michelle Wee video news conference the other day. And if I had had to write the story off of just that, it would have been a really boring story. But luckily for me, I have been covering Michelle Wee since 2006. And so I was able to talk to her a little bit afterward, because I've established a relationship with her. And I knew what questions to ask and was able to take stuff that I just know from having covered her for over a decade and fold it into the story. And it became a much richer story. But if someone is on that call and this is the first time they've ever talked to Michelle Wie, the story, through no fault of their own, is going to lack any kind of layer or nuance or richness. And more, that's what I'm seeing in journalism, is one source stories and just real hit, 6-paragraph just to get a headline on us and a salacious quote. That's not journalism in my world. I want to go deeper and try to give you a little more. To me, that's cotton candy. I want to give you a 5-course meal. I was doing a story. I spent 2 years, and again, the luxury of privilege, I'm not unaware of it, while I was on the golf beat trying to report the definitive Patrick Reed story, because his parents talked to one reporter who then really didn't get Patrick's side of it. Blindsided Patrick on the Sunday he had won at the Masters and said, "I was at your parents' house. They're really sad they weren't at the course. Why do you not want them here?" I mean, that was not how to get a fair and balanced story. So I set out to really try to figure out what has happened to this family that it's become so fractured. So it required walking many rounds with Justine, his wife, and talking to Patrick, and Patrick seeing me show up day after day and realize, like, wow, she really is invested in my story. She's not just, she's walking the walk, literally, not just talking the talk. So I gained their confidence and they said, "Sure, you can come to Houston and we'll open up to you." So I made my arrangements. I was set to go. And then I get a text from Justine. She said, "Hey, before you come here, we just want to make sure we're on the same page on one thing. We don't want you talking to his parents." And I said, "I can't make that deal with you, because if half of what I think this story is about comes out in our time together this weekend, I'm absolutely going to have to go back to his parents, not to get the tit for tat, but to just present this to get their reaction." And she said, "But I don't understand. The other people who have done this story haven't talked to us, so why do you have to talk to the parents?" And I understood her frustration, because there are people in journalism who don't look at stories that way. "Oh, the parents, they want to give me a bunch of sensational quotes and stories about how they've been wronged. I'll do that story. So what if I can't get Patrick to really sit down and I can't get to the bottom and unravel the web that is very complex here? I'll do that, because it'll get a lot of clicks." And that story did get a lot of clicks. So it's tough for those of us who want to keep doing these stories. I wonder if there really is an audience for them anyway anymore, because I do see a lot of very one-dimensional stories doing quite well in the metrics that now seem to matter, clicks and whatnot, social media mentions. But I hope you're right that there's still room for deeper storytelling, because I think it's only by going deep that you really can, only by telling the story as completely as you can you draw the proper lessons from people's lives.
Yeah, totally. And who knows whether there's an audience for it. It's my aspiration to test it and see. I think if there is one, it's a niche one, but it might be a big niche, or it might be a global niche. It might not be something that might be viable in Baltimore or Savannah or Dublin. But maybe there is an opportunity to do it at a global niche level. And that's kind of what I'm after. And hopefully we can make something happen. But Karen, it's been a real pleasure. I'm very grateful for your time.
Oh, it's been a privilege to sit and talk with you. Thank you so much.
If I can spring a question on you just as a final question to wrap up, who is, when you look outwards at other sports writers and maybe people who are active right now or people who you've come across or you've read their work in the past, in the recent past or the dim and distant past, who is somebody that springs to mind immediately? And is there a piece, a seminal piece that you could point us to if that isn't putting you completely on the spot?
No, well, anything that Sally Jenkins writes, I'll read. I think she is fantastic. She always has thoughtful takes. She's a beautiful wordsmith. So anything she writes, I will read. There was a story in Sports Illustrated about Jill Costello, who was a rower who, I won't give the story away, but it was so wonderfully done that when I taught a journalism class last year, it was the first story I thought, like, oh, I have got to make sure that I have this story. And of course, I'm completely drawing a blank on the author. And I've even, you know, he's a friend of mine, so I'm mortified. But that's what happens when you have these senior moments. Chris Ballard.
Chris Ballard, yes.
And he has written so many great stories. He wrote a story a few years ago that got traction after the Michael Jordan series because he wrote this story on Brian Williams, who disappeared and then was found dead. And they think that his brother killed him. But he had made an appearance in the Jordan series because he was a teammate of Jordan's on the Bulls. And I reread that story recently, and it was even better than I remember it. So Chris Ballard, for sure. And he's someone who just recently was laid off at Sports Illustrated. And our profession is the poorer for him not writing regularly. I'm starting to feel as if the talent that's on the sidelines right now is greater than the talent in the game. So those are just two names. I'm sure all the people you've talked to, they're all people I read regularly. But I know so many young people say, like, oh, who should I be reading? And I think there's a real danger in developing your favorite authors because you have to find your own voice. We all have our own voices. And I think I had to learn this early because at the first few newspapers I worked at, I was the only woman in the section. And I absolutely came from sports from a different point of view. And yet I was surrounded by all these men who had what they thought were important, the results, the statistics. They all wanted to be Rick Riley, who is a humorist that no one should try to imitate someone like that. It's like trying to imitate Mark Twain. That's a losing proposition. But for the first few years I was in the business, I was really trying to be that kind of sports writer. And I finally figured it out. I'm glad I figured it out sooner rather than later, that that's not me. So I've just got to write what I think is important and write sports as I see it. And hopefully there will be an audience for it. Hopefully the way I see sports, other people will see them that way too, and will appreciate my stuff. And even when I was at the Savannah newspaper, I used to get letters because back in the day, that was what it was, letters, not emails or tweets or texts, from the wives of the coaches of the teams I covered. And they would say, you know, Karen, I don't really read the sports section because I'm not much interested in the results, but I'll read your stories because your stories aren't really about the results, they're about the people. And that is my voice, that for the first couple years, I sort of self-censored myself. I was self-censoring because that wasn't the kind of writing I was seeing my colleagues doing. So that's why I'm always a little cautious to send people to these wonderful writers and say, you should be reading these people. Now, I definitely think you should be reading. I'm on day 22 of No TV, and it has transformed my life because the hours I would have spent watching mindless TV, I'm reading books. I'm up to 59 books in 2020. So I just think that by reading through osmosis, improving your vocabulary, although you probably can't tell that I have more than a fifth grade vocabulary with the way I talk. My words sort of escape me when I'm using the spoken word. But it's funny because I went about 6 weeks between stories in the newspaper. I took a little time off and then I was traveling, then I was quarantining. And usually when I take that kind of time off, it's not like getting back on the bike or getting back on the horse. I have a few wobbly stories before I get back into a groove. But I think because I've been reading so much, I actually was able to rather seamlessly get back into it. It has to be that. There's no other explanation. So I'm not sure it matters who you read. Just that you read everything that you can get your hands on.
I have to ask, you dropped it in there. You're on day 22 of No TV.
Yeah.
What was the motivation for that decision?
So it's kind of funny. My husband was with me in London at the start, and we moved to our long-term rental during the second week of the lockdown. So just imagine that scenario, what that's like being in a two-room flat on top of each other when at least I have work. And he really was thinking, oh, this is going to be so great. While she's working, I'll go to pubs and I'll go to museums and I'll walk around the beautiful, vibrant streets of London. No, none of that was happening. So what did he do? We got a TV license as soon as we were able, and he watched hours and hours of TV. And I think in reaction to that, I just thought, I just can't do that. He's back in the States now. So part of it is the TV shows that we watch together, and we had a couple favorites. I think I'll be sad if I watch them without him. So that was part of it. And then we got this weird email saying that we owed our television tax was coming due, which it turned out that was not true. But it got me thinking, well, what if I don't turn my TV on and they can't charge me the tax? So it was for stupid reasons, but now that I'm out of the practice, it's the first thing I do when I'm done writing or researching at the end of a day is I reach for the book at my bedside table, whatever I'm reading. And I'm reading all kinds of stuff. None of it has to do with sports. But every book I've written has given me some food for thought on some sports story. So that's the connection, yeah. The connectivity that I absolutely love.
Karen, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes, the pleasure was all mine, Shane.
Shane here again, really briefly. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sports Writer's Life. If you enjoyed the show, please do one or all, if you like, of these three things. First of all, a review would be amazing. Find the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or whatever system you use. If there is a review functionality, go ahead and post a review. That helps to get this show to more listeners around the world. If you don't know where to go, I will post a link to the Apple Podcast review system in the show notes of this episode. Secondly, please do subscribe to The Sports Writer's Life to make sure that all 12 of these episodes appear in your podcast player as they go live in the coming weeks. And thirdly, head on over to magnificentirrelevance.com to hear more about the plans for this new publication, which aims to bring readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing each week. Thanks again for being here. This is Shane Breslin signing off, and I'll be back to you soon with the next episode of The Sports Writer's Life.